From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capital Notes podcast for Friday, July 2nd. I'm John Myers from KQED, Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly, the Vuvuzela King.
Only 12 days, shopping days left to La Bastille Day.
Ah, good. You skipped right over the 4th of July and you've moved right on to the French holiday. That'll win you lots of fans out there with the patriotic crowd.
Well, there's no shopping days left until the 4th of July because today's Friday, so...
Yeah, that's true. And we are out of days to solve the state budget on time.
Segue.
So, sorry we missed you last week, or I missed you last week. I was on furlough. Anthony was working.
I was here.
You were here. You just didn't have the keys to the castle to turn on the recorder and do your own podcast.
I don't know how these internets and technologies work.
We don't let Anthony in here on his own. He's not supposed to be here unsupervised.
No, I have my court... ordered guardian waiting outside the podcast booth.
Exactly right. We'll escort you out otherwise. Yeah, so I was on furlough doing home improvement projects and not getting paid. And so here I am. Slightly getting paid. We won't go all the way back into ancient history of what happened over the last week, of the week before that we were here. But so let's talk about this week, which is probably, I would say budget... Bond, politics, campaign.
Okay,
that's it. Thanks. Goodbye. That's what happened. So budget. Boy, we can't miss talking about that big July 1st budget deadline that once again the state has no spending plan in place, as though any of us are shocked that there is no spending plan in place. Because until this week, we had three plans.
Right.
And now we actually have two, so there's improvement. Well, there's progress.
We have two halves, so we maybe between
One. We have one that we've actually seen. We have one that we hear is an actual plan, but we know some sketches of it. What I'm sitting here talking about is that the Democrats in the Assembly and Senate say they have merged Wonder Twin powers. It's a
form
70s,
of an eagle.
70s cartoons reference.
Shape of an ice cube.
Exactly. Yeah. They have merged their budget plans into one Democratic proposal. Assembly Speaker John Perez and Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg met with the governor hours before the old fiscal year ended on Wednesday.
It was already over in parts of northeastern Maine.
Interesting. And Australia and places like that.
Oh, yeah.
Keep on traveling over the time like
over the day.
So they met and, I think all of us, you and me and other reporters included, basically talked to all the same staffers who kind of gave, the big 30,000-foot view of what this budget looks like. I find instructive, though, or at least interesting for those who don't watch everything in politics, I find it interesting the way this happened. This is the ultimate in a soft release, a soft sell of a budget plan, right? Or soft opening, as they call it in the business world, right? You know, where you open a business but you don't announce it quite yet. It's like, we want people to know that we've come up with something, so we're not just doing nothing. But we don't want to roll out a whole budget and have the interest groups pick it apart and yell and scream.
Well, and because we saw this week. I mean, we saw this week that the California Teachers Association sent out another mailer.
Which looked like junk mail, but that's another story.
Well, hey.
It was an envelope. I almost threw it away. But anyway.
Some people might say it was, depending on who you were talking to. But it was a gentle nudge aimed at Senator Daryl Steinberg, the leader of the state Senate, whose original budget, had a number for public school funding that was a couple of billion dollars less than the budget introduced by Speaker John Perez. So this week, the Democrats agreed on an education number.
The assembly number.
And it was the assembly number.
$54 billion.
And I think, I don't know this to be true, but I think that part of the reason there was no big kumbaya press conference between Steinberg and Perez this week was that, Steinberg had a problem. Obviously, this mailer made it look like if he was to run out there and embrace the assembly number after this mailer dropped, that he was capitulating because of pressure from CTA. So I think that those types of relationships and that level of micro politics and interest group politics does tend to complicate these budget negotiations. We see it, the dynamics between the two leaders and the houses, and I think the administration and their staff trying to sort of drive a wedge in between Steinberg and Perez. I mean, that's been my read on my conversations with them. I don't know if you've had that experience or not.
I was on furlough, sorry. But anyway.
So, I mean, you know, there's a lot to a budget, a lot that people don't see that involves, you know, some fragile egos and some kind of petty politics that tend to that play into this struggle to reach a compromise.
Well, let's sketch out, and actually not sketch out because it's really all the sketch I got.
It's very vague.
Of what we know about what they're willing to do, at least where the Democrats are at this point. So education, about $54 billion. That's the Prop 98 guarantee that you hear a lot about. That is above where the Senate was originally, and it is several billion dollars above where the governor was in his May revise.
And the major issue there with that $54 billion is that it includes payment of what's called the maintenance factor when the state is on the hook to pay back schools. There's a question because of the arcane nature of the Prop 98 formulas and the way it was constructed, and there was an unforeseen consequence essentially that precipitated by this economic collapse that we're in the middle of, where the formulas go a little bit haywire. And there's a question of whether or not the state is on the hook for about $11 billion to pay schools. This issue came up last year, and it was...
And was settled.
They punted because they in the form of Prop 1B. It was one of the... Yeah. They sort of agreed to disagree and pave over it for a year. Well, now it's back because Prop 1B failed. So there's a question of whether or not this $11 billion is actually owed to schools. I think that's going to be the central... That's going to be the end game, you know, for the budget, is agreeing on a number there and figuring out what to do about the public school funding. I mean, it's a huge part of the budget. You know, we've got a general fund budget of about $90 billion. K-14 is on the hook to get $54 billion of that. I mean, that's, what, 60%? I mean, that's a big chunk. And I think that's a lot of what this budget fight is going to be about.
Okay, but let's also talk about what else is in this framework, past education. So the controversial securitization, cash advance, you might call it borrowing plan of Assembly Democrats has been... We don't know the real modification of it. They say it has been set aside in terms of the budget deficit. So in other words, the money that would be have come from this borrowing from Wall Street, and the part of that money that would have been used to solve this year's budget deficit is no longer part of the plan. They still are looking at it. I mean, that's the right way. This is what you've heard as well, right? They're still looking at it for like a jobs package or paying back local governments.
Right.
But they're not counting part of it towards the $19 billion deficit any longer.
Right. Well, there's a hole in the budget now of about $5 billion, my understanding is of this sort of vague number, of what they're leaving open to generally, you know, again, in capital parlance, what they call one-time solutions.
Yeah.
Usually that means borrowing. Sometimes that can be a one-year fee increase or tax increase, whatever it is. But I think that the Assembly Democrats are still holding out hope that this securitization plan will be part of this $5 billion in one-time solutions. But my understanding is that in this outline, that the securitization plan is not specifically a part of it.
Right. And the one-time stuff could be other kinds of borrowing, could be fund shifts, loans, all the kind of little stuff.
Can it be HUDA again? Can we say HUDA?
HUDA. we've retired that and the vuvuzela.
Boo.
I got several criticisms online about the vuvuzela. They didn't like that buzz.
You know, they're just not sport lovers.
They weren't World Cup fans. taxes. It looks as though the Democrats are going to stick with for now. They're going to, you know, run up the negotiation flagpole, the oil severance tax, and the rescission of the corporate tax breaks from last year's budget deal, which gets you about, from what I understand, about $3 billion in the budget year.
Right. Roughly $2 billion from the tax breaks being rolled back and about $1 billion from the oil severance.
That's assuming you could actually get those in Republican votes and the governor's approval, but remains to be seen. And then I think everyone is going to agree on a number that's pretty close to what the governor wanted for federal money. About $3.4 billion,
even though
a lot of people are saying we ain't getting that money.
Right.
And as one person said to me, it doesn't matter. We'll all write it in there.
Right. Welcome to the budget.
That's the way we do budgets. That's not actually anything new. And of course, then, you know, Democrats are rejecting things as they have in conference committee already about the elimination of CalWORKs and things like that. And I think you know, I've run into no one at the Capitol who thinks that if the governor was handed his May revised budget right now, he would actually sign it.
Right.
And therein, I think, is a powerful message, too, about what the governor actually believes in, that, you know, the, whether or not he actually really believes in those unbelievably difficult cuts and program eliminations.
He doesn't. I mean, look, the May revise was a punt. It was a punt. I mean, two things.
Well, punt or a negotiating tactic. Who
knows? Negotiating tactic because it keeps the legislative Republicans behind the governor. But I think that's what the speaker's been saying all along, is like, okay, you're gonna do something that doesn't make a single Republican mad. You're going to put together this proposal that keeps every Republican happy. We're going to put together a proposal that's equally as unrealistic. That's going to keep every Democrat happy. And that's been sort of the difference between the speaker's approach and the pro tem's approach. And that's caused some conflicts. Another big piece of this sort of vague compromise proposal, there is the realignment proposal.
Exactly.
You know, the shifting of some state services, the responsibility of those services over to the counties.
With some way to pay for them, which of course becomes complicated too, because in this original Senate plan, the oil severance tax is tied up in that.
Right.
So who knows how this all gets resolved.
Right.
But you know what's interesting about realignment? I mean, we don't want to go deep into that right now. It is a budget reform idea.
Yep.
And in all this talk about that the governor needs a budget reform to sign a budget,
it would allow him.
This would allow him a victory in that way. I mean, depending on how he defined reform.
Would the governor really take a Democratic proposal and then seize ownership over it? Let's ask Fran Pavley, shall we?
That would be a reference to AB 32.
It's a little greenhouse gas joke. Yeah. But
that was a nice little drum beat you got there in the studio.
Rimshot.
I think the rest of this, you know, we'll just kind of have to obviously see how it plays out. I mean, the other thing about the perspectives, too, just quickly before we
pivot,
stop talking budget, simply because there really is anything else to say about the budget. I mean, we're early in this game. The public feels this is late in the game. But as everybody knows here in Sacramento, this is early
wrong.
In the budget negotiating dance because they haven't really started picking it apart yet. But it's also, too, about this way of how you construct what you're doing. And this, I think, goes to what you were referring to a minute ago, Anthony, of the differences in the two Democratic leaders and not just Democrats, but Democrats and Republicans, which is when you're faced with a problem like this, is your best approach to figure out how much money you have, in other words, how big your pie is, and then how to divide it, or do you decide otherwise how many programs you want, how much spending you have, and then you have to go find the money to
right.
fit that bill. I mean, it's looking at two different sides of the coin, but they are very interestingly – but they're very interesting – it's an interesting debate. And I think it goes to show a lot of the mindset problems and the fights we have here about, you know, whose approach is the right way to go? Is it right to say, look, this is all the money we've got? Or is it, as some would argue, especially people on the liberal side of the spectrum would say – look, you know, these are moral choices. You know, we have to find the money for this. These are important programs,
right.
And on and on and on.
And that's a question of existing revenues and then also new revenues. I mean, I think Democrats will all tell you that revenues are going to be part of this package. And they're probably going to devise some revenue scheme which will not require a two-thirds vote. So
all of this, just because you get to the magic two-thirds thing, all of this is playing out in the middle of in the beginning of a campaign season over the vote threshold for a budget, which mm-hmm. is going to be on the ballot in November. All the props got their numbers this week.
Yep.
Can't remember that one off the top of my head. Oy. And also the one about two-thirds, creating a two-thirds vote for fee increases
right.
in the legislature.
And
every little bit of this budget debate, you know, has got to influence those campaigns in a way, and everybody is watching it, wouldn't you say, in a different way this time, especially if you're involved in those campaigns and
right.
you care about that, because every headline that we write about the budget debate or gridlock or, you know, tricky little move here or there, you know, some voters are going to say, that's why we need the two-thirds vote, or that's why we need to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And boom, ba-boom, ba-boom.
And both of those campaigns are similarly going to be attacking the legislature for the way they do business. Whether it's, you know, we're going to see a reprise of the old food fight commercial the last time we voted on a majority vote budget, remember? Back in, when was that,
2004?
Mm-hmm. And I think that the you know, the so-called Sinclair fix, right, where the two-thirds vote for fees initiative, that will also focus on some of the fees that will get raised or some of the majority vote revenue increasing proposals that we've seen in past budgets in the recent past, and I'm sure we'll see again this year.
Well, the one ballot measure I now know by heart number, because it will not exist on the November ballot, is Proposition 18. At least we think it will not.
Right.
Well, we think it will not. I know, asterisk, asterisk, caveat, caveat, because it hasn't actually happened.
Right.
But this week, Governor Schwarzenegger and Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg and the campaign in support of the $11 billion water bond, also now known as Proposition 18, said they support its removal from the November ballot and delayed until 2012, until the election in 2012. Mm-hmm. Primarily because everybody knows, I guess the polling shows, the voters aren't interested in borrowing $11 billion.
Really? I've got like $2 you could borrow.
$11 billion, $2.
Yeah.
Okay, but your caveat is that, right, the legislature has not acted yet to formally move it to the 2012 ballot.
Well, and I think this is...
And what, you think maybe there's still some jockeying going on?
I know there is.
Okay,
I mean, I think that, we saw Senator Steinberg come out when the governor made his announcement earlier this week. Senator Steinberg immediately came out. Apparently, he had met with the governor the night before and agreed to support the concept of moving... to take the measure off the ballot because it was placed on the ballot by the legislature. The legislature can move it if they get a two-thirds vote. Now, we've seen this before with the
high-speed rail
bond. Mm-hmm. A couple of times it was moved. So Steinberg apparently was able to extract. He got an extra appointment on the Delta Stewardship Commission. That was his ask for doing this. The speaker met with the governor, came up, and he has poignantly not committed to putting up the votes to get this thing off. And I think, again, it's just negotiating tactics. I mean, I think that John Perez, if he's going to do a quote-unquote favor for the governor to try to save his water bond by moving it off the ballot, he wants something in return. And I think that's just kind of – it's instructive about the different styles of the two leaders. And, the odds are this gets resolved. I just think that it might get resolved as part of a larger deal.
Well, and then there's other politics, too, because, I mean, this water agreement was nothing if not controversial, and it was another one of those marathon, all-night, push-and-pull kind of sessions that we have over the budget and other stuff.
Yep.
And so, you know, as recently as a couple of months ago, people who were supporting the bond and who'd been involved in that said there's no way it's going to get pulled off the ballot because once you do that, you allow the opponents to crack open that ugly little egg and start demanding this concession, that concession, and you re-debate the whole thing. And so now here we are. We could be faced with that. I mean, we could be faced with the you pull it off, there's no guarantee it goes back as it is. You reopen that debate over – conveyance and water supply issues
monitoring.
And dams and on and on and on and on. I mean, who knows?
Yep.
That would be a good time.
But that won't be Arnold Schwarzenegger's problem.
No, that would not be. That would not be. I mean, the other element, too, of course, is that if it comes off the ballot, it's one less thing Arnold Schwarzenegger has to defend or be part of a campaign in some way, shape, or form. Maybe not.
Right.
Out there in campaign ads, but raising money, doing whatever, because the governor's got an awfully crowded November ballot. I mean, that is something that I think is worth noting, too. He had the water bond to defend as part of his legacy. He's got redistricting to defend as part of his legacy, and perhaps the addition of congressional districts to this new Citizens Commission.
Right.
He's got the absolute hallmark defense of AB 32, the greenhouse gas law. So pulling the water bond off makes Arnold Schwarzenegger's life easier. I'm not saying that's the primary consideration.
Right. No. On some levels, on the other hand, though, you're going to have a governor who's going to be interested in constructing a narrative about his legacy, and the water bond was going to be part of that. And so he won't have that, you know, that sort of feather in his cap, so to speak. Now, he's got enough of a story to tell about infrastructure, about all the infrastructure bonds we passed in 2006. But I know that the administration, part of the reluctance to, it was a lot of folks were pushing for this bond to be moved off the November ballot. They'd been pushing for weeks, if not months. The governor was holding the line from what I heard, and I think that if that's true, it's because he wants this as his legacy, and moving it off the 2010 ballot I think reduces the possibility that this gets associated or affiliated with the Schwarzenegger gubernatorial tenure.
Just means that once he's left office, if it moves off the ballot, he gets to come back and campaign on something.
Hey, he's going to raise money for it.
Uh-huh. We'll be following the former governor around the state then.
That will be interesting.
So some stories never go away. Right. But yeah, so it's not off the ballot yet. There's a sense that that's where things are moving. That's what you said. But there are still some moves to be played there. And that would leave us with 9 measures on the November ballot, which that's actually something we talked about in the last podcast. We might as well tie up that little bow.
Right.
Is that, you know, there was some hand-wringing that some of these things weren't going to get through their signature verification in time. As it turned out, none of that happened. Silly me.
Well, apparently, you know, congressmen were on the phones with county registrars at the 11th hour.
You must be referring to a particular measure.
Yes, on the redistricting measure.
Yeah, well, the one to abolish the redistricting commission, which was the one that was the last one in the door. And there was a lot of discussion as to whether or not they were going to finish the vote counting. But so there'll be 9 measures on the ballot if the water bond's pulled. We don't have to say too much about it right now, but it's a hell of a confusing ballot.
It is. And I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this, and I was discussing this with the speaker yesterday, about 4 of these measures at least are really sort of get at the heart of budgeting and the way the legislature does business. You've got the 2 of them we already mentioned, the two-thirds vote and the fees vote. And then you've got another local government protection.
Well, a full-on ironclad ban this time on any future borrowing of transportation and local government funds.
Which, incidentally, the speaker came out against this week, and the mayor of Los Angeles.
Who asked him that question at the press conference?
I don't remember.
Vuvuzela King.
The mayor of Los Angeles seemed to be a little confused about his position on that measure. But that's another podcast.
That's an LA podcast.
There's another budgeting. What am I missing? Anyway, there's a 4th one. It'll come to me momentarily. But, you know, once again, we have a lot of these. Well, the term limits one didn't qualify. But a lot of these measures sort of get at the heart of how the legislature conducts its business. And we saw in 2009, you know, voters went to the polls and said, no, we don't want to discuss this stuff with you guys. You know, well, depending on your interpretation of those results. And so it'll be interesting to see how these campaigns form and how they sell themselves to voters and what the appetite is for the voters to sort of inject themselves into the business that constitutionally, you know, normally belongs to the legislature.
The other budget one is the repeal of the tax credits.
Oh, right.
The corporate tax credits, which is now part of a budget negotiation this summer. But if it doesn't happen there, I think it's got a heck of a good chance on the November ballot, because it's just, you know, it feeds into this, you know, populism, big corporate America angst. But we can talk about that on a later podcast, obviously. And then there are the very strange but politically understandable, if you watch the behind the scenes politics of the redistricting measures, one to expand the commission, one to abolish the commission.
Right.
The global warming one that we've talked about.
Marijuana legalization.
And then, of course, the one that the chairman of the Democratic Party, John Burton, says will bring everybody out, the legalization of marijuana, which is a wild card out of all of these other measures that you've kind of seen. I mean, and it's a wild card, too, I would argue, because it was not – I was going to try to make some, like, you know, joke about the people who were supporting of it, but it was not circulated through the normal political world.
Right.
It came in from a different avenue of direct democracy.
I'm setting the over-under for the POD initiative at 39%. I think as you begin to look at this, they've got some issues about the way it was drafted, and they're going to make this not a conversation about legalization of marijuana, but about the unintended consequences. The No campaign will make this about the unintended consequences of what would happen if this specific measure was enacted. It's very similar to, remember, we had a debate about the 3 strikes. Was it Prop 66, 67?
Yep.
Whatever it was, a couple years ago.
Also 2004.
Where it was this Prop 66 was way ahead in the polls. And then in the last month of the campaign, a bunch of folks, a lot of former governors got together and some prosecutors got
together.
Current
governor.
Current governor as well. And said, look, this isn't about 3 strikes. The way this is crafted would would have all sorts of consequences that have nothing to do with three strikes specifically. And it tubed the measure. I mean, it ended up failing overwhelmingly. And I think that we're going to see something similar to that happen with the POD initiative, and that we might be voting on this again in 2012. And Call it a hunch.
It's going to get a lot of national attention because it is one of those only in California kind of things.
And Maine.
Yeah, but Maine, California, come on.
Yeah.
And then speaking of that November election, just briefly, as we continue to follow the early days of the race for governor.
The dog days of summer.
The dog days of summer where they're trying to get someone to pay attention. Not a lot happened in the Jerry Brown versus Meg Whitman contest over the time since we last talked. But, you know, these feelings of the way the campaigns are moving and the way the candidates are setting things up, you know, continues to move forward in this way that is really odd. I mean, you know, the Whitman campaign is really running this, I still would argue, kind of 30,000 feet from the ground kind of campaign where they are doing things like websites in Chinese. I mean, they are buying up the entire world of political communication, it seems, in a way, or changing the way that these campaigns are run. And then, of course, the night and day opposite Jerry Brown and two aides and his wife and
three aides. They hired Nick Velasquez.
Oh, did they? Yeah. Okay, well, good. To Nick, a shout out to a Democratic operative. There you go. But okay, so three aides and his wife. But it's still a very unusual campaign from his end.
Full
of Jerry Brownisms, which I wrote down a few from his interview on CNBC this week, where there's no Santa Claus.
Boo.
No Santa Claus. Where let me save. Anyway, that state government is currently, and I quote the former governor, constipated, unquote, and that where's his budget plan? Well, the plan is the process of getting people to talk together. The plan is the process, he said. Now, that last one, I've heard him say now for a while. That's not surprising because, again, I think this gets back to the way Brown is selling himself. He's selling himself as a leader who knows how government works.
Right.
Whether that works in the fall, I don't know.
Well, and Whitman is selling Brown as somebody who refuses to talk specifics and is a career politician. So anyway, it's a little disingenuous to say there's no Brown campaign because there is this proxy.
Am I being disingenuous?
Well, there's this proxy campaign that the independent the labor unions are funding.
Excuse me of being disingenuous?
No, I'm saying that characterization was whoever made it.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
Characterization itself was disingenuous, not the author.
Whoever's idea I'm ripping off. Okay, got it.
So you're a plagiarist and a liar.
Well,
this proxy campaign, and there are commercials on the air attacking Meg Whitman, paid for by the same folks who are funding Brown's campaign. And the truth is, between now and Labor Day, to some degree, the paid media campaign of these unions and these independent expenditures is the Brown campaign. I mean, it is the paid media portion of the Brown campaign.
I would agree with you, but I would say just as a point counterpoint kind of moment here.
John, you ignorant slut.
Exactly. The challenge here is that independent campaign is all anti-Whitman.
For now.
But that's an important distinction for now. The Whitman campaign is actually running a pro-Whitman campaign in addition to the beat up Jerry Brown.
But there
isn't a pro Jerry Brown campaign of any size right now. It is the former governor waxing either eloquently or oddly on the day's news. And I think that is the part that people have hooked on to about, does that work?
Well,
is that selling him as the guy that voters want?
Well, already we have two radio ads that are paid for by this other union group. Not California Working Families 2010, but just Working Families, I believe it's called. There are positive Jerry Brown radio ads on the air being paid for by the electrical workers and some other unions. I believe that there are some pro-Jerry Brown ads coming from another independent expenditure group.
So your message is stay tuned.
Yeah, it is coming. And frankly, I mean, the Whitman ad that I see on the air now. I mean, just watching TV, the Whitman ad that I see is the 60-second anti-Brown ad. And so a lot of it is this, I don't know what kind of rotation the pro-Whitman ad is in, at least the ones that are in English, not the Spanish language ads. But that's another story.
Yeah, well, no, that's not another story. Let's talk about it for a moment.
No, let's not. I don't want
to. Come on.
I'm getting out of here.
No. Come on, stay a little longer. Let's do two podcasts. No, but let's, I mean, no, some of this, it just merits at least a brief mention. First of all, let's set aside the Spanish language ad just for a moment. Well, now that I set it aside, I've forgotten what the heck else I was going to talk about. Let's talk about the Spanish language ad.
Okay.
That is an important pivot from the Whitman campaign right now.
Good luck with that.
Well, no, but yeah. But this is their pivot from the primary to the general.
Right.
And, you know, and this also goes to show why Whitman walked. It depends on who you talk to. Some people believe she stepped way over the line on immigration. Other people will say she walked right up to the line, you know, and stopped on the Arizona law issue and stopped on denying services to the children of illegal immigrants. In other words, she walked as close to it as humanly possible, you know, for a primary. And again, it depends on who you talk to. Some people
right.
think she clearly jumped over into the right wing side. But this is that, I mean, this is that important pivot, and whether it works, yeah. I mean,
well, but, and it's interesting on the Spanish language campaign. I mean, there's a question of whether voters remember Jerry Brown generally, right, going on, and what their memory is of Jerry Brown. This is also another test about the power of Pete Wilson to motivate voters in the Latino community. I mean, Pete Wilson is shorthand for all that is mean and nasty, right, among Democrats.
From Prop 187 from
right.
1994.
So, and so time and time again, and we even saw Whitman turn to Pete Wilson when she was coming under fire from Steve Poizner.
And now he's back
on
in
the
an
issue
undisclosed
of immigration.
Location.
Right. Although Democrats haven't forgotten that, and Democrats are going to point out in Spanish that, hey, look, this is the governor. Look, this is the gubernatorial candidate who stood with Pete Wilson, who Pete
He's
Wilson.
The chair of her campaign.
Right. And so something tells me, call it a hunch, that's where the Spanish language campaign is going. Now, you know, is that cynical, oversimplistic, you know, perhaps, but I still think that that's kind of the level, you know, that is the level of that. Of discourse we're going to be talking about. I mean, Whitman in Spanish is talking about how she did not support 187. And I think Democrats are going to try to complicate the picture that she's trying to paint of herself.
I haven't heard the ad. Is it heard in Spanish? She's speaking in Spanish?
No. It's not heard.
Oh, okay.
It's a narrator.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just two things quickly on the campaign. One is, I don't know. I know what the Whitman campaign will tell me if I ask them this. I mean, because they don't, you know, if they believe it, they wouldn't say it. But if you look at the, you know, it's this early snapshot Reuters poll about the matchup that we had this past week. If you didn't see it, it roughly said Brown had about a 6-point lead on Whitman. And all of that does beg a question. I heard Brown bring it up this week, and I do think it's reasonable to say. She spent all this money. She has this massive operation. He has three guys and his wife, as I've already been told. And this is either still Brown ahead or an even game.
Yep.
And so is this what they knew was going to be the case? Are they scratching their head about that? Is this just a sign that they haven't really yet begun to fight on the Whitman side? I don't know. But I mean,
Or is it that they need to tear Jerry Brown down to her level? I mean,
well, but what's interesting is that there are parallels being made. Wouldn't you agree that some people are saying, "Oh, Brown needs to not fall into the trap that Steve Poizner fell into," you know, where he didn't respond for weeks and weeks and weeks, and she went on the air and she beat him senseless.
Well, and again, the unions are filling that void. There.
True, but except that Jerry Brown is not Steve Poizner. Jerry Brown has 100% name ID.
I think that's fair to say.
But I mean, in some ways that are positive to him. Jerry Brown starts this at a stronger position than Steve Poizner did.
Yeah, absolutely.
He doesn't have to define himself in the same way. And doesn't have to be, is not as susceptible probably to being defined by Whitman as quickly and as simply as Poizner.
Although
was.
Whitman's trying, and again,
she's trying hard. I mean,
and that is a question of how much do people really have, how much do people really know about Jerry Brown, and what do people think they know about Jerry Brown? I mean, look, the guy was governor, you know, in 1974, right? That's 35 years ago. That's a long time ago. And so people have heard the name, but the question is, do they have a perception of who he is and what he is? And I think you see Whitman really trying hard to write this narrative, and Brown battling back with the narrative of his own, the blue Plymouth, you know, getting rid of the state jet.
You wrote on that, the back and forth of, did he really get rid of the jet this week?
Did he sell it? Did he get rid of it? Anyway, but, you know, but that whole narrative is part, and now we hear this week, Jerry Brown, I've heard him say, I think, 5 times this week about how he vetoed 2 proposed pay increases for state employees. Workers. And so he's trying to distance himself. He's trying to paint himself as somebody who's not afraid to stand up to his friends and say no. So that battle, the framing debate, I mean, that's sort of where we are now, July, you know, the first days of July here.
You know, I have to say, have you noticed how the Whitman campaign always refers to him as Governor Brown?
Yes.
And that is not by accident.
Right.
It cannot be by accident. I mean, you know, simply because I think anything they can do to paint him right as the incumbent and her as the outsider – they believe helps her, even though he hasn't been a governor for 28 years.
I just wonder if there's...
And he's the attorney general. But anyway, you just notice in campaigns normally, like where titles don't get used sometimes when you're the challenger because you
sometimes
don't want to...
Sometimes just Jerry.
Yeah, you don't want to elevate whoever it is. But, I mean, Governor Brown is in every statement they make.
Can I call you Joe?
Thank you, Sarah. And with that, that's probably a good place to end.
Okay.
Ooh, yeah, look at the clock. Okay, well, we apparently had way too much to talk about from being gone for a week. So next week we'll bore you with no budget news.
Woo!
That's Anthony York from Capital Weekly. I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.